quite so.
Carpentry, though, I think, by using a great many measures and instruments that give it a high degree of precision, comes out more exact than most of the sciences.
In what way?
In shipbuilding and housebuilding and in many other kinds of woodworking, it uses the ruler, I think, and the lathe, the compass, the chalk line, and a certain ingenious contraption for aligning things.
Quite right, Socrates.
Let's set the so-called arts, then, into two groups, those that go along with music, sharing a lesser degree of precision in their work, and those that go with carpentry, sharing more.
Let it stand so.
And of these, the most exact are the ones we mentioned first just now.
You seem to mean arithmetic, and the arts you named just now that go along with it.
Certainly, but Prodarchus, shouldn't we say these two come in two kinds? Or how do you see it?
Which kinds do you mean?
Isn't there one arithmetic practiced by the many, and another practiced by philosophers? Shouldn't we say that first?
How would one draw the line between one and the other kind of arithmetic?
It's no small distinction, Prodarchus. Some people count unequal units when they reckon, two armies, say, or two oxen, or two of the smallest things there are, or two of the very greatest. Others would never go along with them unless one insists that not a single one of all those countless units differs in the least from any other.
You're quite right that there's no small difference among those who busy themselves with number, enough to justify calling them two distinct things.
And what about this? Calculation and measurement as practiced in carpentry and commerce, compared with the geometry and calculation practiced in philosophy, should we say each of these is one thing, or set them down as two?
Following what we said before, I'd cast my vote for calling each of them two.
Rightly so. Now do you see why we brought all this into the middle of the discussion?
Perhaps, but I'd rather you were the one to answer the question you're now asking.
Well, it seems to me that this argument, no less than when we first began to make it, has set up something to stand opposite the pleasures, by asking whether one branch of knowledge is purer than another, just as one pleasure is purer than another.
Yes, that's quite clear, that this is exactly what it's been aiming at.
So then, hadn't we already found, earlier on, that one art was clearer than another applied to different subjects, one more exact and another less so?
Quite so.
And in these cases here, hasn't he used a single name for what is really two arts, creating the impression that it's one thing, and then asked all over again, as though there were two, which of the two, the philosopher's version or the non-philosopher's, has more clarity and purity in these matters?
Yes, that does seem to be what he's asking.
Then what answer shall we give him, Prodarchus?
Socrates, we've come to see a tremendous difference in the clarity of these branches of knowledge.
Won't we find it easier to answer then?
Certainly, and let it be said that these two are far superior to the other arts, and that among these two, the ones connected with the drive of true philosophers surpass the rest immeasurably in precision and truth about measures and numbers.
Let that stand as you say, and trusting you, we can boldly answer those who are skilled at pulling arguments in every direction.
Answer them how?
That there are two arithmetics and two arts of measurement, and a good many other such pairs following along with them, sharing this same twin nature while being called by one common name.
Let's give this answer, and good luck to us, to those clever fellows you speak of, Socrates.
So we're saying these are the most exact of the sciences.
Certainly.
But Prodarchus, the power of dialectic would refuse to have anything to do with us if we ranked any other science above it.
And what science must we call this one, then?
Clearly, anyone would recognize the one just described. I think that everyone who has even a small share of intelligence believes that the knowledge concerned with what is truly and always constant in the same way, is by far the truest kind of knowledge. But what do you think? How would you settle this, Prodarchus?
I've heard it said again and again, Socrates, by Gorgias, that the art of persuasion far surpasses all other arts, for it makes everything its slave through willing consent rather than through force, and is by far the best of all the arts. But I wouldn't want to set myself against you or against him right now.
It seems to me you wanted to name your weapon, but felt ashamed and left it behind.
Let it be however you think it is.
Am I to blame, then, for your not understanding correctly?
For what?
My dear Prodarchus, I wasn't asking, at least not yet, which art or science surpasses all the rest by being the greatest and best and most useful to us, but rather which one looks toward clarity, exactness, and the truest truth, however small its scope and however little benefit it provides. That's what we're looking for now. And see here, you won't offend Gorgias by granting that his art has the advantage of practical mastery over people, while granting to the pursuit I'm describing, just as I said before about the color white, that even if it's a small thing, so long as it's pure, it surpasses whatever is large in quantity but impure, precisely in being the truest thing of its kind. So now, having thought this through carefully and reasoned it out well enough, without looking to any usefulness or reputation the sciences might have, but asking whether there is some power native to our soul that loves the truth and does everything for its sake, let's say, once we've thoroughly investigated it, whether this power has acquired, as far as we can judge, the purest possible share of intellect and understanding, or whether we must look for some other power more sovereign than this one.
I'm considering it, and I think it would be hard to grant that any other science or art holds more firmly to truth than this one.
Now, did you have something like this in mind when you said what you just said, that most of the arts, and those who have labored hard at them, work first of all with opinions and pursue matters of opinion with great intensity? And if someone thinks he's investigating the natural world, you know that he spends his whole life investigating this world around us, how it came to be, how it's affected, and how it acts. Shall we say that, or how?
That's how it is.
So such a person has devoted his labor not to what always is, but to what comes to be, will come to be, and has come to be.
Very true.
Could we then say that anything about these things becomes clear with the most exact truth, when none of them has ever remained, or will remain, or now remains in the same state?
How could it?
How, then, could anything ever become certain for us regarding things that possess no stability whatsoever?
I don't think it could. In any way.
Then neither intellect nor any science concerning these things possesses the truest truth.
It doesn't seem likely.
So we must set aside entirely, you, me, Gorgias, and Philebus, and affirm the following through our argument.
What is that?
That certainty, purity, truth, and what we call unmixed reality belong either to those things that are forever constant in the very same way, utterly unmixed, or, second to those, to whatever is most akin to them, and everything else must be called secondary and inferior.
Very true.
And isn't it most just to assign the finest of name to the finest of these things?
That seems likely.
Aren't intellect and understanding the names one would honor most of all?
Yes.
So these names find their most precise and proper use in application to thoughts concerning what truly is.
Certainly.
And indeed, the very things I brought forward earlier for our judgment are nothing other than these same names.
Of course, Socrates.
Well then, If someone were to say that, regarding understanding and pleasure and their mixture with each other, we're like craftsmen who need the materials out of which, or in which, to build something, he would be making a fine comparison.
A very fine one.
So after this, shouldn't we attempt the mixing itself?
Of course.
And wouldn't it help to remind ourselves of a few points first?
Which points?
The ones we mentioned before. The proverb seems right that what's worth saying well is worth repeating twice, even three times.
Of course.
Come then, by Zeus. I think this is more or less how what was said before went.
Hello.
Philebus claims that pleasure is the correct target for all living things, and that all of them ought to aim at it, and further that this very thing is the good for everyone, and that the two names good and pleasant rightly apply to one single thing with one single nature. Socrates, on the other hand, says this isn't one thing but two, just as the names are two, and that the good and the pleasant have natures different from each other, and further that understanding has a greater share in the good than pleasure does. Isn't that what was said then, and what is being said now, Protarchus?
Absolutely.
And wouldn't we also agree, both then and now, on this point?
Which point?
That the nature of the good differs from everything else in this way.
In what way?
That whatever living thing possesses it, always, completely, and in every respect, has no further need of anything else but has everything sufficient and complete. Isn't that so?
Yes, it is.
And didn't we try, in our argument, to set each of the two apart from the other, testing them separately in the life of each creature, pleasure unmixed with understanding, and understanding likewise, having not the slightest trace of pleasure?
We did.
And did either of the two seem sufficient to us at that time?
How could it have?
And if we went astray at all back then, let anyone now take up the matter and correct it, treating memory, understanding, knowledge, and true opinion as belonging to one and the same class, and considering whether anyone would choose to have or acquire anything at all without these, let alone pleasure, however great or however intense, if he neither truly believed he was enjoying it, nor knew at all what he was experiencing, nor retained any memory of the experience for any length of time whatsoever. Let him say the same about understanding too, whether anyone would choose to have understanding entirely without pleasure, even the smallest amount, rather than combined with some pleasures, or would choose all pleasures apart from understanding rather than combined with some understanding.
That's not possible, Socrates, but there's no need to keep asking this over and over.
So neither of these two could be the perfect thing. The thing choiceworthy for everyone, the holy good.
How could it be?
Then we need to grasp the good clearly, or at least get some outline of it, so that, as we said, we'll know to whom to award second prize.
Quite right.
Well, haven't we found a certain path toward the good?
Which one?
The way that if someone were looking for a particular man, and first found out correctly where he lives, that would go a long way toward finding the man he's after.
Of course.
And just now some argument showed us, as it did at the start, that we shouldn't look for the good in the unmixed life, but in the mixed one.
Certainly.
And there's more hope that what we're after will show up more clearly in a well-mixed blend than in one that isn't.
Much more.
Then, Protarchus, let's pray to the gods and start mixing, whether it's Dionysus or Hephaestus or whichever god has been given the honor of this blending.
By all means.
And indeed we have, standing by us like a pair of wine pourers, two springs. You might compare pleasure's spring to honey, and understanding's to some sober, wineless, healthy water. And we must do our best to mix them together as well as we can.
How could we not?
Well then, first, if we mixed every kind of pleasure with every kind of understanding, would we hit the mark best that way?
Maybe.
But that's not safe. I think I can show a way to mix that's less risky.
Tell me what it is.
We agreed, didn't we, that one pleasure is truly more true than another, and likewise one skill more exact than another.
Of course.
And knowledge differs from knowledge, too. One kind looks at things that come to be and perish, the other at things that neither come to be nor perish but remain the same, in the same way, forever. Judging by the standard of truth, we decided the second was truer than the first.
Quite rightly.
So if we first mix together the truest portions of each, would that blend be enough, all by itself, to produce the most desirable life for us? Or do we still need something more, even some things that aren't like that?
I think that's what we should do, at any rate.
Then let's suppose we have a man who understands justice itself, what it is, and can give an account that follows his understanding, and who thinks the same way about everything else that is.
Let's suppose so.
Will this man have adequate knowledge, if he has an account of the circle and the sphere themselves, the divine ones, but is ignorant of this human sphere and these human circles here, and uses the same rulers and circles when he builds a house and does everything else?
What we're describing, Socrates, is a ridiculous state to be in, if we're confined only to the divine sciences.
What do you mean? Must we throw in and blend together with the rest, even the unreliable, impure craft that uses the false ruler and the false circle?
We have to, if any of us is ever going to find his way home.
And what about music, which we said a little while ago is full of guesswork and imitation and lacks purity?
It seems necessary to me, if our life is going to be a life at all, in any sense.
Do you want me, then, like a doorkeeper shoved and jostled by a crowd, to give in, throw the doors wide open, and let all the sciences pour in and mix together, the less pure right along with the pure?
I certainly can't see, Socrates, how anyone would be harmed by having all the other sciences as well, so long as he keeps the first ones.
Shall I, then, let them all flow together into the reservoir of Homer's, and indeed poetry's, meeting of the waters?
By all means.
They're let in. Now we need to go back again to the spring of the pleasures, because our plan to mix in only the true pleasures first, that didn't work out for us. Instead, out of our fondness for every kind of knowledge, we let them all flood in together before we ever got to the pleasures.
That's exactly true.
So now it's time for us to deliberate about the pleasures too, whether we should let all of these in as a mass as well, or whether here too we should let in the true ones first.
It makes a great difference for safety's sake to let the true ones in first.
Let them in then. What comes next? If some pleasures are necessary, as was true there, mustn't we mix those in too?
Of course, the necessary ones, surely.
And if, just as it was harmless and beneficial to know all the crafts throughout one's life, the same holds now for the pleasures, if it's actually good for us and harmless to everyone to feel every pleasure throughout life, then we should blend them all in.
So how should we talk about this, and what should we do?
It's not us we should be questioning, Prodarchus, but the pleasures themselves, and the kinds of understanding, asking them something like this about each other.
What sort of thing?
Dear friends, whether we should call you pleasures or by whatever other name, wouldn't you rather live together with understanding of every kind or apart from thought altogether? I think they'd be bound to answer this.
What?
What we said before, that for any single kind to exist alone, in isolation and pure, is neither really possible nor beneficial. And of all the kinds, we hold that the best thing to have living alongside us is the capacity to know everything else, and in turn to know itself completely, as far as that's possible for each of us.
We'll say they've answered well just now.
Rightly so. Next, then, we must in turn question understanding and mind. Do you need any pleasures at all in the mixture? We'd be asking mind and understanding this in turn. What kind of pleasures? They might well ask.
Likely enough.
And here's how our argument goes next. Besides those true pleasures we mentioned, we'll say, do you still need the greatest and most intense pleasures to live with you? How could we, Socrates, they might well say, when those pleasures throw countless obstacles in our way, throwing the souls we live in into turmoil with their mad excess, and won't even let us come into being in the first place, and as a rule, through the carelessness they breed and the forgetfulness that follows, they utterly destroy whatever offspring of ours do come to be. But the pleasures you called true and pure, take those as belonging to us, more or less, and along with them the pleasures that come with health and self-control, and indeed with the whole of virtue, all the pleasures that follow virtue everywhere as its attendants, the way attendants follow a god, mix those in. But as for the pleasures that are forever tagging along with folly and the rest of vice, it would be sheer irrationality to mix those in with mind. For anyone who wants to see the finest, least conflicted blend and mixture, and to try to learn from it what the good really is, by nature, in a human being and in the universe, and what form we should divine it to have. Won't we say that mind has answered wisely and consistently with itself, on behalf of itself, and of memory, and of correct opinion, in what it's just said?
Absolutely.
But then there's this too, which is necessary, and without which nothing could ever come to be, not even one thing.
What's that?
Whatever we don't mix truth into could never truly come to be, and even if it did come to be, it couldn't continue to be.
How could it?
No way at all. But if this mixture still needs anything more, you and Philebus should say so. As for me, the argument now looks to me like it's produced something like an incorporeal order that will rule beautifully over an ensouled body.
Then count me as agreeing that's how it is too, Socrates.
So perhaps we'd be right, in a sense, to say that we're now standing at the very threshold of the good, at the door of its dwelling.
I think so, at any rate.
Well then, what element in this mixture would strike us as the most valuable, and at the same time most responsible for making such a disposition dear to everyone? Once we've seen this, we'll go on to examine whether it's more closely allied and akin to pleasure, or to mind, in the nature of things as a whole.
Right, that's the most useful thing for us in reaching our judgment.
And indeed, it isn't hard to see the reason why any mixture whatever turns out to be worth everything, or worth nothing at all.
What do you mean?
No human being is ignorant of this.
Of what?
That any mixture whatsoever, made in any way at all, that misses measure and the nature of due proportion, necessarily destroys its ingredients, and itself first of all. Such a thing isn't really a blend at all, but a sort of unblended jumble, and it turns out, every time, to be a genuine disaster for whoever possesses it.
Perfectly true.
So now the power of the good has taken refuge for us in the nature of the beautiful. For measure and proportion, surely, everywhere turn out to be beauty and virtue.
Quite so.
And we also said that truth is mixed in with them, in the blend.
Yes, indeed.
So then, if we can't capture the good under one single form, let's take hold of it with three: beauty, proportion, and truth, and say that we'd be most right to treat these as if they were one thing, as responsible for what's in the mixture, and that it's because of these as being good that the mixture has turned out as it has.
Quite right.
At this point, then, Prodarchus, anyone at all could serve as an adequate judge between pleasure and understanding, as to which of the two is more akin to the best thing and more valuable, among gods and among men.
That's clear, but still, it's better to work it through with the argument.
Then let's judge each of the three, one by one, in relation to pleasure and to mind. We need to see which of the two we should assign each of them to as more closely related.
You mean beauty, truth, and proportion?
Yes, take truth first, Prodarchus, and having taken hold of it, look at the three, mind, truth, and pleasure, and after taking your time, answer yourself. Is pleasure more akin to truth, or is mind?
What do we need time for? I think the two are worlds apart. Pleasure is the biggest fraud of them all, and, as the story goes, in the pleasures of sex, which are held to be the greatest, even perjury gets forgiveness from the gods, as if pleasures were children possessing not the least bit of sense. But mind is either the same thing as truth, or of all things the most like it and the truest.
Then next, consider proportion the same way. Does pleasure possess more of it, or does understanding possess more than pleasure?
That's an easy question, too, the one you've set before us. I think you'd never find anything by nature more lacking in proportion than pleasure and its excess of delight, and nothing more full of proportion than mind and knowledge.
Well said, but go on and give me the third one too. Has mind gotten a greater share of beauty than the class of pleasure has, so that mind is more beautiful than pleasure, or is it the other way around?
Well, Socrates, no one has ever seen or imagined understanding and mind as shameful, whether waking or dreaming, at any time, in any way, whether in the past, the present, or the future.
Rightly said.
Yes, and pleasures too, even, one might say, the greatest of them. When we see someone in the grip of pleasure and notice either the ridiculousness that follows or the utter shamefulness of it, we ourselves feel embarrassed. And we do our best to hide it out of sight, handing all such things over to night, as though daylight had no business seeing them.
Then you will proclaim it everywhere, Prodarchus, sending messengers to the absent and telling it to those present, that pleasure is not the first thing worth possessing, nor even the second, but that the first prize, the eternal one, has been won by whatever belongs to measure, the moderate, the timely, and everything else of that sort.
So it appears, at least from what has just been said.
The second prize, then, goes to the proportionate, the beautiful, the complete, the sufficient, and everything else of that family.
So it seems.
And the third, as my own divination tells me, if you set down intelligence and wisdom there, you would not stray far from the truth.
Perhaps.
And then in fourth place, those things we assign to the soul itself, the branches of knowledge, the arts, and what we called correct opinions, shouldn't these come forth, right after the first three, since they are more akin to the good than to pleasure?
Perhaps so.
And fifth, then, the pleasures we set apart, defining them as painless, calling them the pure pleasures of the soul itself. Those that follow upon knowledge, as opposed to those that follow upon the senses.
Perhaps.
But in the sixth generation, says Orpheus, let the order of the song cease, and it looks as though our own argument, too, has come to a halt at the sixth judgment. Nothing remains for us after this except to set, so to speak, ahead upon what has been said.
Yes, we ought to do that.
Come then, let us call once more, for the third time on the same God as our Savior, and go back over the argument.
Which argument do you mean?
Phoebus maintained that the good for us was pleasure, all pleasure, entire and complete.
It seems, Socrates, you were just now saying we ought to take up the argument again from the beginning. That was your third time.
Yes, but let's hear what comes after that. For once I had seen through the things I have just gone over, and grown weary of Phylbas's claim, not only his, but that of countless others as well. I said that intelligence was by far the better and superior thing for human life, compared with pleasure.
That is what you said.
But suspecting, too, that there were many other things in play, I said that if something should appear better than both of these, then I would fight alongside intelligence for second place against pleasure, and pleasure would be deprived even of second place.
Yes, that is what you said.
And after that it became utterly clear that neither of the two was sufficient by itself.
Very true.
So in this argument, weren't both intelligence and pleasure entirely ruled out from being the good itself, or even a substitute for it, seeing that they were deprived of self-sufficiency and of the power that belongs to what is adequate and complete?
Quite right.
And once a third thing appeared, better than either of these two, intelligence has now shown itself to be, by an enormous margin, closer akin to the character of the victor than pleasure is.
How could it not be?
So then, by the ranking our argument has just now revealed, the power of pleasure would come in fifth.
So it seems.
But first place it certainly will not hold, not even if all the cattle and horses and every other kind of beast should insist on it by their pursuit of enjoyment, trusting them, as though they were birds, and we the prophets reading their flight. The many judge that pleasures are the strongest things for living well, and think that the cravings of beasts are more authoritative witnesses than the arguments divined, again and again, in the company of the philosophically muse.
We all say now, Socrates, that what you have just said is entirely true.
Then will you let me go?
There is still a small bit left, Socrates, for surely you will not give up before we do. I will remind you of what remains.